Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Gownley. Welcome back to the show. It's Unpacking Peanuts. We're here in 1957 talking about Charles Schulz's masterpiece comic strip, Peanuts. I'm one of your hosts for this evening. You might know me from my comic book series, Amelia Rules, or my two books, Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up, or The Dumbest Idea Ever. And joining me, as always, are my co-hosts. He's a composer for both the band Complicated People and this podcast. He's a playwright. He's co-creator of the original comic book price guide, the Argosy Price Guide to Comics. And he's the cartoonist behind such great strips as Tangled River, A Gathering of Spells, and Strange Attractors, Michael Cohen.
Hey there.
And he's the executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, the former vice president of Archie Comics, and current creator of Instagram strip Sweetest Beasts, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
Guys, it's 1957. This is really exciting. We have the opportunity for the first time ever to tell people where Peanuts takes place. So how about we all take a trip back to Hennepin County, Minnesota?
Yeah.
Where Peanuts takes place. Guys, what do you think? Is that amazing or what? I don't know if anyone's ever figured this out or not, but that seems to be where it takes place.
Right. It's in there. It's through Lucy gives it away because she has been what named the Fuss Budget of the Year for Hennepin County.
That is correct. Yeah. And that is a county outside of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area in Minnesota, which makes total sense.
Or in Minneapolis, right?
Oh, is it?
Minneapolis is in Hennepin County.
Yeah, is in okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I think it's the county seat, right? Or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, when I read that, it's in the February 15th, 1957 strip, if anyone wants to look it up on Go Comics or in your Fantagraphics volumes. Jimmy had mentioned in the 1956 edition that he had figured this out and he had read ahead. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, wow, that is so cool. Because you can go on to Google. I'm sorry I do not have the address with me. You can look it up, though. You can just write Charles Schulz address, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and it will pop up on Google. And you can go on to Google Maps, and you can see this beautiful home that's set way back off of Minnehaha Parkway in Minneapolis. And it's a large house. I mean, it's quite impressive, the size of house that they were in. Of course, they had a lot of kids. We've got Amy, who's now 1 year old, Craig, who's 4, Monty's 5, and Meredith is 7 this year, 1957. And I don't know what the size of the backyard was. I haven't looked at the lot lines, but the front yard was massive. And right across the street was Minnehaha Creek. And so this parkway is, and you think of parkway, you think, oh my gosh, the kids, be careful, loads of traffic. But if you look at the Google Maps picture, it's like, that's a parkway. Okay.
Is that where the bridge is?
I checked for the bridge because you guys were talking about the bridge that you had figured out that the wall, the stone wall that you see, usually Charlie Brown and Linus in later years, but I guess it's everybody over time, standing at and just kind of putting up their elbow in their hands. Was not just a wall, it was a bridge based on a couple of really beautiful angles he drew occasionally. And I was like, is there a stone wall? Is there a stone bridge near this house? And if you go out of the house and turn left on Google Maps and you go about the equivalent of a block and then head off to the right, there is a little beautiful wooden bridge and wood, I guess it's wood and steel, but mostly wood. That curves along the way he has it in the strip, but it's at least the version it is now is not a fancy, and it's a pedestrian bridge to cross the creek to get to the other side of the Minnehaha Creek.
Amazing. That's very cool. That's one of the great things about being able to look at this thing strip by strip, you know, day by day, because you find these little things that are not a part of the grand image of Peanuts in everybody's mind, but that when you're a huge fan, it just delights you when you see that. So Michael, what are your thoughts here on 1957?
I think we've got Schulz in absolute peak form. Everything's fallen into place. He's not being as innovative, because I think he's got the cast he needs and doesn't feel there's some gap he has to fill in with a new character. He's got this family of kids, a variety of ages, which corresponds to the characters somewhat. So he's probably got lots of inspiration at home. And he's hitting home runs just about every day. It's this 56 and 57. I don't see any real radical changes, but I think generally it's slightly stronger in 57, which would make this the best year.
Yeah, it is. We're at a point now where it's kind of a disservice to say settling into a groove, because it's such a high level groove. They're all, like you said, they're all hits. They're all home runs. But it is interesting. We're also seeing the loosening up of the art style greatly.
Yes.
And how do you guys feel about that? We're edging for me personally towards more and more what I think of as the pinnacle of Peanuts, that sort of looser look. But there is part of me now that's looking back and going, oh, there was a lot of really nice stuff about that early drawing. I don't think it ever would have been the pop cultural success that it became, but it does feel like there was some good stuff there early on.
I'm mostly seeing the art change in Snoopy, who's probably at his most flexible at this point.
It seems like Schultz is giving himself the freedom to be looser, and that it's actually a goal. I mean, there is something that we might want to mention here in 1957. He settled in with his family and his home. This next year is going to be a major change. But in 1957, this is about as settled as he's been since the strip has started. But he adds to his workload this year. He adds that syndicated strip, It's Only a Game. Mm-hmm. Which was a 3 times a week strip, or a Sunday strip that you could buy that would have three panels. Essentially, it was a panel comic about sports and games and bridge and these sorts of things. And he takes this on as an additional workload, even as Peanuts is exploding. He doesn't need it for the money, I don't think, but it seems like he has ambitions to see where he can go with, you know, his overall workload. So It's Only a Game opens in 30 newspapers, which was more than the 7 that he had for Peanuts, largely, I think, on the name of Charles Schultz. And Schultz writes and draws it for about 1.5 months. And then he hires, I don't know how you pronounce this, I think it's Jim Sasseville. Does anyone know?
That's how I always said it, but I don't know.
To illustrate these. And at the same time, this year is the year where original Peanuts comics are going into the comic books. So that is interesting, because all of a sudden Schultz is creating a little business around himself, and he hires Jim to cover both of those things, the comic book and It's Only a Game. And he's paying him, I think it starts at $100 a week, which is it's like a 25% raise over what he had been paid at art instruction schools, where Schultz got to know Sasseville. And so they begin this really great relationship in the beginning, and there's now this extra workload on Schultz. And you know, when I see this year and I see that this is what he's up to in this time, it seems like he might be taking some of his time away from Peanuts, and he's streamlining his process. Maybe that's why we're not seeing as much innovation this year, is just because there's less of his time possibly going into Peanuts this year versus, say, the previous year or two. It's a guess, but just based on what he's working on, it seems like that might be a pretty safe bet to say.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, but it is also a clear artistic decision, because he is leaned into this new gestural style, and it looks absolutely great. It's still not really following any kind of animation template, but it's very lively, you know, particularly Snoopy dancing and stuff like that. It has such a great bounce and life to it. I'm really enjoying just looking at the art. So there's so much great stuff in 1957. What do you think, guys? Should we just kind of get right to it?
Sure.
Sure.
All right. Let's look at the strips. January 27th. It's a snowy day, and we see Lucy outside making a tiny little snowman. She looks at it and then kicks it over. Then she remakes another tiny little snowman, which she then kicks over. She repeats this a third time, with Charlie Brown watching. confused by the whole process. Then, in the last panel, Lucy looks at the last destroyed snowman and says, "I feel torn between the desire to create and the desire to destroy."
Well, we all are, aren't we?
I wonder if Schultz could have related to something like that when he has to create something every single day. I can't see it.
I mean, I can see it. The first two strips we picked here both have to do with the creative process. And this might relate to his feelings about doing Peanuts every day, because he probably didn't just draw one for each day. He might have gone through one and then got angry and tore it up and then started another one, tore it up. So maybe this is a reflection on that.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I remember reading a story. Schultz, the way he would compose these strips, he would pull out a yellow legal pad or whatever, and he would just doodle the characters on the yellow legal pad until something struck his fancy, and you know, he'd indicate dialogue or whatever. And when one didn't work out, or just when he was finished with it, he would take them, crumple them up, and throw them in the wastebasket. And it wasn't until decades into the strip that his assistant started coming in at the end of the, or his secretary, I believe it was, would come in at the end of the evening and take all those drawings out of the trash and straighten them out and fold them away, because, you know, by that point, we want to see everything, including the stuff you were throwing away.
Huh, that's interesting. Has anyone ever published those or printed?
You see things? Oh, yeah, I was going to read. There is, oh boy.
I thought you were going to say that Chip Kidd has come out with a book where they have crumpled all of the paper to the exact folds as he had, and it's just this big wad bound together in a single volume.
Well, it's so funny that you should mention that, because I was going to recommend a Chip Kidd book, but I can't. What's it called? Like Only What's Necessary or something it's called? And it's really cool. I sort of didn't pay much attention to it because I thought of it as less than, let's say, the Peanuts, the Art of Charles Schultz book that he put together. But I was looking at it recently and it's fantastic. And it does have a lot of preliminary drawings that are in there. And none of them it's not a 3D art experience. But if Chip Kidd ever listens to this, maybe that'll be his next Peanuts project.
Just for clarity, so is Only What's Necessary a completely Schultz oriented book?
Yes. It is like a behind the scenes, very Chip Kidd production, because it has gorgeous photography of original art and clippings that have never been reprinted, including some of those ads from the launch of the strip. And it has the original art for one of the greatest Sunday pages that we discussed, the comic rack where Charlie Brown is reaching for the throttle. And when you see it it's not quite the size of the original art, but it's much larger than you see it in any of the books. And you see it, his original pen lines and stuff. It's even more impressive. There's one where Charlie Brown is sort of taking a comic off the rack. And so the comic itself is curved, and he draws the cover and the title along the curve to match it. It's really, really beautiful stuff. So yeah, if anybody it really wants to get into seeing what Schultz was putting on the page on a day-to-day basis, that's a great book to look at. February 6th, Linus approaches Lucy, holding out a coloring book for her to inspect. He says, "Look, Lucy, look how nice I colored in my color book." Lucy yells at him, saying, "Are you crazy? Do you want to be frustrated and inhibited for the rest of your life? Good grief. Don't you know that if you color inside the lines in a color book, you'll become inhibited? Worse yet, you're liable to become good at it and end up as a commercial artist." Linus recoils, saying, "Horrors." I love it when Schultz takes a good dig at the commercial artist.
Is he throwing a bone to his art instruction school?
Yeah, colleagues? And I assume he thought of himself as a commercial artist, obviously, because he said things like you can't fault the salesman for selling out, or his job was to sell newspapers. So he definitely looked at himself in that tradition as well.
Yeah. It seems like all the comic book artists in that period who were pretty much disgusted with the comics code coming in and how little they're getting paid and how little work there was, they almost all dreamt of being a commercial artist. But the highest dream was to do like a newspaper strip. That was, and then if not, then become a commercial artist. And the very bottom, the dregs, would be doing comic books.
Yeah, at this point, you would not even want to tell your friends and family that you drew comic books in 1957.
For Charlton.
I don't necessarily want to tell people. No, I'm just kidding. I love being a cartoonist. I love it's like being a Jedi Knight to me. The other thing I want to say about this is the third time he used the phrase frustrated and inhibited, and it's years apart.
It flows.
It does flow. So I Googled it just to see if it's from something else, and the only thing that comes up is Lucy. So I don't know if that was just something in the vernacular at the time.
No, we don't know, but it should be the title of this episode.
February 9th, Snoopy is out in the snow. He's on all fours and he looks very determined. He thinks, here comes the big polar bear stalking across the snow. Snoopy watches as Charlie Brown walks by. Then he chases after him. In the last panel, we see Snoopy tucked inside Charlie Brown's coat. And Charlie Brown says, I'll bet real polar bears never get cold.
So this is another new impersonation, animal impersonation for Snoopy. It's his polar bear.
It's a great drawing in that first panel, I think, where if you just looked at it, you would think, oh, that's a drawing of Snoopy and he kind of looks intense or whatever. But the way he's drawn the legs is different than the way he would normally draw them for Snoopy. There's a different weight to the body. It's amazing that indicates polar bear somehow, even though it's a cartoon drawing of a dog. It does work as also a polar bear.
It works.
So I think every drawing of Snoopy in this strip is gorgeous. Every panel is different and just wonderful Schultz artwork. The second panel in particular, where we see Snoopy at an angle we don't always see.
Yeah, as a polar I love bear, that.
Is just amazing against the snowy landscape. And the other thing I wanted to mention about this strip that is something that I think Schultz introduced last year, but he does more and more as things go on, is he has this world where Charlie Brown knows what Snoopy is thinking. So Snoopy's imagining that he's a polar bear, and then the punchline is Charlie Brown is the one who says, I'll bet real polar bears never get cold. Just the idea that somehow there's this connection where sometimes Charlie Brown understands exactly what Snoopy's doing in his imagination, which I think is pretty magical.
Yeah, it's very cute. It's a great little relationship that's building there. March 3rd, Lucy is sitting watching television. Linus is standing next to her. He says, why can't we ever watch what I want to watch? He continues to implore her. Why can't we, huh? Why can't we? I'm tired of always having to watch your programs. Linus is getting more upset, but Lucy just sits and watches television. Linus continues, in fact, I think I'll change the channel right now. I think I'll walk right over there and change the channel. That's just what I'll do. I'll walk right over there and turn the knob. I'll turn that knob and I'll change the channel. I'll just walk right over there and turn that knob and change the channel. That's just what I think I'll do. I think I'll walk right over there and turn that knob and change that channel. In the last panel, Linus sits down next to Lucy, resigned, and sighs to himself. Siga.
It's time for the peanut time machine.
So do we need to go into the time machine to explain what a channel is?
Well, this does put me into that time machine because I remember the TVs in that time, the screens were tiny. Mm-hmm. And I definitely remember sitting on the floor really close to it. And if you look at Lucy, she's like totally hypnotized. She has no expression. She doesn't respond. She doesn't even notice Linus. It's just like the TV is sucked her in.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because that would be the pose or that would be the expression we would see today on a kid with a cartoon kid with a phone, right? That would be the thing that has them that blank stare and hypnotized and not aware of what's going on around them.
Mm-hmm.
So everything old is new again. I always loved this strip. This one I remember. I just love the rhythm of the language that Linus uses to complain about changing the channel.
I remember this strip when I was probably about 7 years old reading this and totally related to it as the younger brother and the older sister and wanting to watch the different programs. And yet being the younger kid, you know, there is some seniority there. There was fairness in the house, but still, you know, you just get upset when there's something you really want to watch.
Right.
And there's no way you're going to get to do it. And the idea that he's thinking through exactly what he would do if he had the bravery to do it with his older sister. I just, yeah, this is a little kid I remember that resonated with me.
Yeah, I was an only child, so I got to watch whatever I want, but it gives me such great respect for my dad, who would sit there and watch like Dukes of Hazzard, and he hated the Dukes of Hazzard. He hated every single thing about the Dukes of Hazzard, but every Friday he would sit there with me and watch it.
That is so funny, because my dad, who normally did not watch television and was like, you know, he listened to classical music, he was that kind of person, he loved Dukes of Hazzard. He thought Boss Hogg was the most hilarious character.
the only show my dad refused to watch with me was Mork and Mindy when they brought on Jonathan Winters. He was like, absolutely not.
It's a matter of principle.
Yes, there, yeah, right? No, there's only so far you can go. But this is a different world. It really is. Like, all kidding aside, I mean, no kid has a TV with a knob on it of any kind. Their primary source of entertainment isn't television at all. And it would never even occur to you to have to fight about what you're watching right this moment, because you can watch anything you want at any time you want. But at this point, if you missed Howdy Doody, that was it. You were never seeing Howdy Doody, that episode of Howdy Doody again.
Yeah. And it was like three channels. But basically, you notice nobody's multitasking here.
Right.
I mean, because now you'd be, you know, checking your phone and you know, people are so restless because there's lots of things to do, or, you know, flipping channels or whatever. But no, that TV has just got her 100%.
One of the things I've really been enjoying about reading these strips is just I read them in the Fantagraphics books. But hey, if you're out there and you want to follow along with us, you can just do it by going to gocomics.com and typing in Peanuts. And all the strips are there for free, which is amazing. Or you could splurge and buy the Fantagraphics hardcover collections. I actually think they might have them in softcover now, too. But those are beautiful. And I've really just been enjoying just sitting with a book and making sure I don't have any distractions and just being immersed in it. It's hard to make time to do that these days, which... it's too bad, because it's one of life's great pleasures.
Brought to you by the Reading Council.
March 4th. Charlie Brown is standing outside. In the background is Shermie. Charlie Brown says, "Nobody likes me. Nobody really likes me." He hangs his head, and Shermie approaches him and says, "I know how you feel, Charlie Brown. I think I know just how you must feel." Shermie continues, "You don't want pity. All you want is a little understanding." Charlie Brown looks at Shermie and says, "On the contrary, I'll take all the pity I can get." Okay, so guys, it's Shermie. Can we add something? Let's check the Shermometer. What can we add to our pal Shermie?
Is it possible that Shermie also thinks people don't like him?
It's possible, I guess, yeah. Because he does understand. So that's interesting. I don't know.
Maybe he thinks Charles Schulz doesn't like him. He never gives me any good lines.
I don't even have a personality trait. Although we are proving that myth wrong. What are we going to add though now for this year? We have to add a character trait.
Empathy.
All right. That's the okay. So Harold is picking empathy. So that's the 1957. Look at the Shermometer. I think Shermie is really shaping up to be quite a compelling character here. March 11th. Lucy is reading the newspaper. She says the earth is overpopulated. Families are getting too big. There are too many babies being born. Now Linus is looking at the paper. Lucy is ranting at Linus. She says, "The earth can't feed this many people." Then Linus says, "Why don't you leave?"
Have we ever seen Linus give Lucy a smart aleck remark?
I don't think.
The last panel should be her punching him in the mouth.
I think she's stunned. She was absolutely stunned.
I think she's briefly considering it. She doesn't know what it means yet.
I like the look on Linus's face as he casually tosses the paper aside in panel three. You know that he has that one in the chamber, just ready to go. He is just waiting for her to finish. All right. Now starting the next day, we have one of these, which is March 12th. We have one of these long sequences, not quite a story, but we're getting variations on the fact that Charlie Brown has insulted Snoopy. I'll read the first one for you now. March 12th. Charlie Brown walks by Snoopy. He says, "Hi, Fuzzy Face." Snoopy thinks to himself, "Fuzzy Face?" In panel 2, he looks even more concerned as he thinks, "Fuzzy Face?" In panel 3, Snoopy is very upset. He thinks to himself, "I must be getting old and sensitive." He walks away, looking downcast, thinking, "A few years ago, something like that never would have bothered me." So we have now a whole week almost of Snoopy having an existential crisis about being called Fuzzy Face. March 13. Snoopy thinks to himself, "Fuzzy Face? He called me Fuzzy Face. It's wrong to be upset by such a little thing. I'll have to get hold of myself." Snoopy walks off, a ridiculous look of forced confidence and happiness on his face. Then he hangs his head and says, "Fuzzy Face, good grief." The next one, we just see Snoopy at night. He can't sleep, even though he's sleeping inside, not on top of the doghouse. That hasn't happened yet. Then he walks out into a field and just thinks to himself, "Fuzzy Face."
One of the things that I'm noticing here that Schultz has not been doing before, he has the boldness to put a strip in a sequence that makes really not much sense,
no sense
by itself without the context of the previous strips. That's a real boldness to do that. I don't know how many other cartoonists of this style, kind of a comic comedy strip, gave themselves that permission. The idea that, you know, he must be aware that more and more and more people are reading his strips outside of the newspaper and would see this sequence. And he might be balancing in his mind, okay, I've got one audience that will experience it this way. I'll have another audience that will experience it the other way. And maybe I'm adding a little bit of intrigue to the strip when I do something in the newspaper that says, hey, someone says, what's this all about? You know, maybe he thinks it's creating some sort of mystique around the strip. I think it works great. Most of the times I was reading it out of the context, but by that time I understood what Schultz was about. You know, it wasn't in the newspaper. I was reading it in the books. Anyway, I just think it's cool that he does this, and it somehow does add something, again, a little magical to the strip, that you come into a world sometimes and you don't exactly know what's going on, but it's somehow compelling.
And he only does it in one strip. He doesn't do it in all the others. There's always a callback in the others to "He called me Fuzzy Face." So even if you didn't see it, you get, okay, someone insulted Snoopy in his mind. This one is there, like Harold says, there is no context at all. But boy, those silhouette drawings look amazing. I mean, we were talking about spotting blacks last episode. I mean, that is a perfect example of just a gorgeously composed panel that's essentially abstract art. It's just some black shapes on the bottom and some white space at the top, and it looks amazing.
Can I interrupt here for a second?
Yeah.
The movie Funny Face came out in 1957.
Oh, there you go. Maybe it's a reference to that.
Mm. Could be.
That's pretty cool. Snoopy obscurity explained.
All right. So we have two more left here. Snoopy is still just thinking it's now the next day, and he's thinking to himself, "Fuzzy Face." He walked by and he said, "Hi, Fuzzy Face." Sniff. Snoopy sniffs away a tear. He's even more forlorn in the next panel. "I can't remember when anything has upset me so. Still, I don't know why it should. After all, what does he expect me to be? Clean shaven?" And now, here's the big finale. Snoopy, with a stern look on his face, sees Charlie Brown coming and says, "Here comes Charlie Brown. If he calls me Fuzzy Face again, I don't know what I'll do." Charlie Brown says, "Hi, Fuzzy Face." Snoopy's ears shoot up in surprise, and he watches Charlie Brown walk by. And then it finishes with Snoopy thinking to himself, "I was right. I didn't know what to do."
I think Liz is right, because the premiere date of Funny Face was February 13th, 1957, just 1 month prior to this. So the word about that, you know, was it probably in trailers at the time he was, he was writing these strips. So it might have been top of mind.
It could even be the type of thing where, hey, let's go see that movie Funny Face, and you mishear it, right? Fuzzy Face. No, funny. Oh, Fuzzy Face. That's funny.
This last one's another case of Schultz using a phrase, a fairly common phrase, and someone taking it literally, where you'd say, like, if you do that, I don't know what I'll do.
Right. I was right. I don't know what I'll do.
Yeah. And I would like to add that Snoopy looks like Audrey Hepburn in the third panel.
Oh, that is 100% Audrey Hepburn. March 22nd. Charlie Brown is outside reading a book. He reads, "Animals feel the coming of spring in much the same way that humans do. Somehow they sense the feeling of newness of life which spring has to offer." Charlie Brown continues reading. "During this time of year, it is not unusual to see an animal bounding gaily through the underbrush." And then we see Snoopy bounding like a kangaroo and literally over Charlie Brown's head in the last panel, a huge smile on his face. On Snoopy's face, that is, not Charlie Brown's.
Yeah.
That is Snoopy bliss. Just amazing, amazing stuff.
Snoopy so seems gorgeous. Happy. He got over the fuzzy face thing. Now he seems to be rather happy.
Oh, and speaking of that, I did want to bring up I had mentioned the angerometer. This is not an angry strip, but I've been asking you guys every year what your sense is as I count through all of the strips, wherever there is a character who appears to be angry, at least one character in one panel, I will count that as a strip that has anger in it out of 365 strips. And I added this year a hapometer. To see, you know, because, you know, those, for some reason, those are the two things at the moment that seem to really intrigue me in terms of how Schultz is kind of measuring the lay of the emotional landscape of the strip. So first off, I'd like to ask you guys, we had an all-time high of 162 angry strips last year, and full 44% of the strips had somebody who was angry. How do you feel this year stacks up against 1956 in terms of anger in this strip?
Oh, my
it's down.
Yeah, my impulse to say it's down, so I'm going to say it's up.
I'm going to say it's 42.
42% or just 42? The answer to
42 strips.
42 strips. I'm going to say 212.
Okay. Well, my count was 129 down from 162. So that's pretty significantly down. 35% of the strips have somebody who's angry. Now, if 129 strips had somebody angry in at least one panel, how many strips do you think has someone happy, like this blissful Snoopy who just showed it? Just, and happiness could be someone is just talking with a happy mouth, you know.
And does the hot happy mouth talk back?
Sometimes.
I'm going to go 212.
Okay.
132.
Wow, it's 124.
Wow, Michael, that was amazing.
That's
really
pretty
close.
Good, yeah. But it's almost identical with the anger. So I was just thinking about that in terms of the balance of what Schultz puts into the strip.
Well, there's a lot of desperation this year, which isn't quite anger.
Yeah, there's all these other things you could look for. Like, I think chagrin was a term that Jim was using. The chagrinometer and, nonplussed. Each of these would have their own level of difficulty in interpreting. But I thought that was interesting that there's just a little, even though the anger is way down, there's a little more anger than happiness in 1957.
I would be curious to see what this type of thing would look like in other strips. Because frankly, I don't think it would be that different in anger, because I do think anger lends itself to comedy. Either the person has a punchline thrown at them and they're angry, or they're the angry person who starts off the thing in the beginning just as a bit, right? Because it's the grit that starts the joke or whatever. I think happiness having 100 and whatever strips is rarer and harder, frankly.
Are you saying that he uses it more or less?
Happiness? Mm-hmm. I think more than the average strip. Even though you think of strip of Peanuts as like a dark and depressing, that's a terrible way to put it. That's not it. But that deals with darker. It's a dark and depressing strip with Snoopy and Woodstock. It's a
the Easter Beagle just breaks my heart.
The April Fool, it'll send you out. No, but you do think it deals with some of the heavier emotions. You think of Charlie Brown's sadness, you think of Lucy raging and stuff like that. But that's part of humor. Like, you can see that in the sitcom easily. It's harder, I think, to translate joy into any kind of art than it is to translate anger. So I'm really surprised that there's that many happy strips or strips with happiness.
that's interesting, because my tendency was to think the opposite. So it'd be interesting. I could probably pull up some collections that I have of just random collections of, you know, BC and, you know, High and Lois or something, and just, and see how it shakes out with the other strips.
Yeah. And then of course you also get into the fact that those other strips a lot of times aren't expressing anything.
That's a really interesting point. You know, I always think of, I don't want to keep ganging up on Tumbleweeds. Anybody who's,
no, let's take Tumbleweeds down. They have
strip Tumbleweeds. I don't even absolutely. It made no sense to me. But basically, it was like a photo stat. He had like 8 drawings of each character. They're completely static. They're very designy, and it's set in, I guess, this Western village or something. But it's everything's deadpan.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, I tried to read it as a kid, because I was going through all the strips. It was in my newspaper. And I, you know, you can't tell anything from the characters in terms of, I mean, you look at this gorgeous, gorgeous image of Snoopy bounding through the grass. And then I think of Tumbleweeds, where Tumbleweeds did not in its design have the ability to express anything like this. It was impossible,
right,
based on the way the guy created it and designed it. They're just static images of deadpan characters with half open eyes.
Joy and happy. It's definitely a difficult thing to convey. When you can do it, I think it does open up the world to you. The Beatles could do it. If you think, yeah, of those early Beatles songs, they're all really joyful and they hit you, and you don't feel that they're shallow, even if it's just about, I want to hold your hand. You feel that there's creativity and excitement to it. But it's
an amazing thing to aspire to.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very difficult. And I think that's what makes it special when you do see it.
Yes. And because I think Schultz doesn't mind going to extremes. When you get that moment of bliss from Snoopy after he goes through a week of sadness with, right, Fuzzy Face, all of a sudden it's just that much more amazing just to see him blissing out like that.
And you have to also take into account that he is a great cartoonist. And if you can't draw Snoopy looking that happy that well, it's not going to convey.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I'm trying to do it in Sweetest Beast. So I have lots of these little moments of joy, and you know, I'm just that much more aware of Schultz's genius when I attempt to capture an extreme like that is honest.
Yeah. And a lot of this has to be keys to unlocking why this strip is actually so funny. Because, I mean, this will be a little behind the scenes, but one of the things Michael said to me about 20 years ago that I have never stopped thinking about, I literally think about it every day I'm working. Michael said, "I hate humor," which I think, by the way, if I had a t-shirt to give to each of these guys, I would give Michael one that says, "I hate humor." And I would give one to Harold that says, "Really? I thought the opposite."
Humor's got to balance off. It plays off of drama.
But
that's what Schultz is doing. I mean, if the idea was to make people laugh in the fourth panel every day,
right,
I don't think I'd like to strip that much.
No, never. You couldn't, because again, like Harold was saying, it's that balance and that going to extremes. But I wanted to say about you saying that is because you said something like, because we had been laughing and talking for like an hour, and you said, because humor, if you read a comic book or whatever, it's never going to be as funny as just hanging out with your friends. And that really struck with me. And I'm like, oh, every time I write something funny, I think it has to be that funny, because I don't want to let Michael down.
A lot of the humor that you put into like Amelia was people hanging out with their friends, and you captured that in the comic by setting it up that it is just people sometimes in conversation and enjoying one another.
I was thinking in terms of movies, because people, you go to a comedy movie with your friends, and if there's like 4 belly laughs, you go, "That was pretty good." And I remember just driving in the car with my friend Mark to go to a movie, and Mark's like the funniest person in the world. I'd be like hysterical in the car, and then we'd go to pay to see a comedy, sit in the dark and
be silent.
Yeah.
Brooding.
Right. Well, you know, that's an interesting thing too that ties in with the comic strip, is that When you go see a movie, it's a communal experience. When you read a comic strip, it's presumably a solitary experience. But I remember going to see the movie, There's Something About Mary, in a packed theater and crying, laughing. The place was rocking. I mean, it was just, everybody was laughing from beginning to end at this movie. And the minute it came out on DVD, or maybe even VHS, whatever it was back then, I was like, I got to get this movie. This is the funniest movie anyone's ever made. And I put it in and I just watched it alone, stone-faced. I was like, what was the big deal?
And yeah, I think it was that was the, you know, the magic magic of going to movies, you know, back when you had movie palaces would have like 5,000 seats. When the Fox Theater opened in St. Louis after they had renovated it in the 80s, they were showing these classic movies on I think it was on Tuesdays or Wednesdays. And people were so excited that the theater had been renovated. They did such a beautiful job. This was like a Fox Theater similar to, say, Radio City Music Hall. Just a gorgeous space. Mm-hmm. And they sold out. They were showing Shirley Temple in Bright Eyes from 1934. And the thing was sold out. 5,000 people had come to see this movie. And it was amazing. And we saw Dangerous with When Wet with Red Skelton and Esther Williams, which is considered, you know, an okay comedy from the 40s. With an audience, it was absolutely fantastic. It was so much fun. Everyone was just into it. And that was amazing. And you know, Schultz doesn't get that opportunity here. He is talking to one person. And I think he kind of tones his humor to match the way he interacts with you. It is a solitary experience. And I think he tapped into something that nobody else had ever tapped into in terms of that one-on-one with both visual and, you know, in verbal elements. Like just nobody had ever done before. He somehow was able to speak directly to people in this kind of quiet way.
Do you think the black and white adds to something like that? Now, when you're doing Sweetest Peace, you're doing it in color, because I think it would look insane if you put it out in black and white today, right? I guess some people do, but it seems like color is part of the equation. And I wonder if that changes it.
I think so. I think it definitely, you know, and I also think of the silent comedies of the 1920s, that somehow it seems to work better when things are starker and more contrasted, and you take information out that is really not going to play into the comedy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, color is an information that you usually don't need for comedy. Mm-hmm. I think there is something to that. And also with the sketchiness, I heard, was it Frank Mancuso, who's an amazing artist, cartoonist, talking about somebody, I think at a university that he knew, who said, you know, cartooning needs to be quick and sketchy looking. You lose something if you put too much polish on it. And this is where Schultz is heading. You were talking about it earlier. And I don't quite understand it, but I think there is truth to it. If there is this sense that it's kind of dashed off, or it could all fly into space because it's so loose, mm-hmm. instead of it just being absolutely perfect, that there is some, I don't know, it's almost like we lean into the strip because the strip is you have to put the lines together. You're more involved somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. And that also leads back to the idea of him on some days not telling you the context, because he's now in the early days, you're required to bring nothing. He just has his little space saver strip, and he's going to give you a little, as they call it, nugget of humor. But now he's an artist, and I think he knows that, and he's going to require a little bit from you. You know, you're going to have to read it every day. Or if not, you're going to miss a couple things. And he's willing to let that go, which is pretty cool. And do also in repetition, because basically we have the same joke the very next day. The difference being how he draws Snoopy dancing. But that difference is enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Theme and variation. And that very next strip.
Would you like me to read about, it?
You can if you like. That'd be lovely.
March 23rd. Charlie Brown continues to read his book. For animals, spring is the best time of the year. Spring releases them from the confinement of winter, and it brings to them, as it brings to us, a wonderful feeling of well-being. Snoopy dances by in his classic Snoopy happy dance pose. Also whistling or singing, it looks like.
Is this the first happy dance with his head up like that?
I think it's the first ultimate happy dance.
Ultimate, yeah, for sure.
And boy, is Snoopy's little neck so stretched out, and the big bulbous nose and that little smile, which is way high up on the snout. It's just, it's just magical. Nobody had ever figured out how to do something like that. And, you know, it's, talk about squash and stretch. He's taking these characters and finding these amazing iconic poses that are not on model. It doesn't matter in Schultz's world if it embodies the thing that he's trying to get across. That's what he's going for. He can, you know, you try to put Snoopy together, all the different versions of Snoopy when he's sitting, when he's lying on the doghouse, on his back, they don't add up.
No.
You know, he has tiny little paws sometimes in the front and the giant hind legs in the back. It just depends on what his needs are. With a polar bear, he's playing with the idea that I've got these thick legs and stiff legs like a polar bear. And it just works. And yeah. That's been a huge lesson to me, is that go for the emotion and try to do it in the most iconic way. And that is way more important than whether the back foot's a little bit larger than it should be, this, you know, versus the last panel.
Yeah, because it can't, I think another trick of humor is it can't look labored over. You're talking about the looseness of those drawings. And I love Harvey Kurtzman's work, but I love Harvey Kurtzman's work particularly when he draws it. When you see the roughs for the original Mad stories and stuff like that, even though the final Mad comic books are some of the most beautifully drawn comics ever done, I think they're funnier when you just see Kurtzman drawing with a grease pencil on newsprint.
I agree. When you, like, the Hey Look strips that he did in the 40s for the Marvel Atlas comics, they're just single page comics with these characters, and they're done incredibly bold brush strokes and really rough. Yeah, I agree. I find those way funnier than the ones he spent a lot more time on in those Mad magazines.
Yeah. Well, it's also like Peter Buck said of music. A lot of your favorite albums were recorded in a few days, and a lot of ones you hate took years. April 7th. It's a Sunday and Linus is up to the plate, but of course he comes holding his blanket. He looks very determined, and as the pitch comes in, he actually slugs it pretty good. Unfortunately, he's wrapped up in the blanket, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 panels of him struggling as Schroeder then tags him out. He never got to leave the batter's box. He then goes back to the bench, sitting next to Charlie Brown. He's holding his blanket, and Charlie Brown says, "You and that stupid blanket."
I wouldn't have the slightest idea how to draw this. If someone described this to me, I mean, just the visual imagination of this blanket wrapping around him, and it looks fairly realistic.
It does. I mean,
he's struggling on. He's like a mummy struggling on the ground.
Yeah, can you imagine?
And
if you were just a penciler or whatever, and you got a script that tried to tell you to do this,
I'd go look for photo reference.
I mean, right? Child with blanket playing baseball.
And then, does that count as an angry strip? Because Charlie Brown's angry in the last panel.
Yes,
it is angry. It's more frustration, though. Okay, I have to interject something before the next strip.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're going to have a guest commentator.
Oh, okay. A guest. Very exciting.
Okay. You're the guest commentator on this one.
I'm a guest commentator on what? This is my favorite strip of all time.
All right. Well, with that kind of introduction, here we go. April 8th. Patty and Violet are standing outside. Linus comes up to them holding something. And he says, "Here, Violet, these are for you because I like you." Linus walks away, blushing, a goofy smile on his face. Violet looks very happy and calls after him, "Why, how nice. Thank you, Linus. Thank you very much." Patty looks at Violet holding her bundle of something and says, "What did he give you?" Violet answers, "Some French fries with a rubber band around them."
I just think that is the funniest thing. I have remembered that for 50 years. It is just the silliest thing in the world. That's all I have to say.
Makes you love Linus all the more.
Yeah, and you know
he
what?
He walks away with that blush, and he's got his little tongue sticking out of his face. It's just so adorable.
Well, talk about drawing something too. French fries with a rubber band tied around them, and they're tiny. And he has to draw it in a way that you can tell it's something bundled up. but you can't tell what it is. But then when she says French fries, you have to be able to look at it and go, oh, of course that's what it is.
and the fact that, you know, once she discovers what it is, there's no disdain. There's no like,
that's what I wanted.
This is gross. Or it's, she's just got a nice little pleasant look on her face. Like,
can you imagine? The medium is the message, I guess. Can you imagine if Charlie Brown gave her some French fries tied in a rubber band? That would go over so well. No, right? Yeah. But with Linus, it's like, oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, he's definitely playing off the characters he's created and doing a beautiful job of building out their unique personalities and relationships to each other.
That's critical. I mean, you think a good comic strip has to have really strong characters, which is true. But his characters are different in relationship to each other. Like Lucy's relationship to Linus is different than her relationship to Charlie Brown, different from her relationship with Schroeder. So he's got these pairs where you rarely see Violet, usually see her reacting to Charlie Brown.
Right.
But her relationship to Linus here is she likes him.
Right.
She's, even though he's little, she thinks he's really sweet.
You don't know which way it's going to go, you know?
Yeah, but you wouldn't look at it when she's nice to him and go, oh, that's out of character. And I wonder, I mean, that's a real magic to be able to do that, where you're like you say, adjusting their personalities based on who they're interacting with.
Well, like even Snoopy, I was just thinking about that this morning, that Snoopy is, you know, he has these strips the last year and this year where he's talking about, oh, I hate that stupid kid. You know, I hate Linus. I hate Lucy's stupid sister. And then, you know, we got a strip that's on the front page of the Fantagraphics collection for 57-58. The Snoopy reaching out to hug Schroeder and Charlie Brown with his just like, hail fellow, well met kind of look on his face. And the punchline is, he loves people. It's like, and it's the same character.
Right.
And it still makes sense. I mean, the complexity that you can have where in one moment you're just, the world is terrible and I can't stand everybody or anybody. And all of a sudden you're out there a sentimentalist.
Like Snoopy relates to Linus as an enemy. Mm-hmm. And he's always like trying to get the blanket. Whereas he relates to Lucy like really kind of sarcastically, like, you know,
although in both instances,
trying to boss me around.
Yeah. In both instances, I also though feel that Snoopy's like, Linus is a play enemy, right? I mean, he's goofing around, I think, a lot with Linus.
I think he gets there, but he starts out actually genuinely feeling contempt for him with his blanket.
All right, guys, clearly there is so much here in 1957. We're going to need another episode to get to it. So how about we break it off here and we ask everybody to come back next week?
Sounds good.
All right. Hey, guys, if you're out there and you want to follow along, you can always reach out to us at unpackingpeanuts.com. That's where you can sign up for the Great Peanuts Reread. And you'll get a weekly email from us letting you know when or what comic strips we're going to be reading. You can also interact with us on social media. We're unpackpeanuts at both Instagram and Twitter. Until then, I've been Jimmy Gallanly from Michael Cohen and Harold Buchholz. Be of good cheer.
Yes, be of good cheer.
Be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gallanly, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
You blockhead!